the 100th podcast of Deer Talk Now on the new platform.
100th episode.
Of the new version. The new.
You didn't have your coffee this morning, did you?
No, I didn't. Not enough of it. I just had like 3 Diet Cokes. As you guys know, we probably told you, we've been doing this podcast in one shape or form since 2011. However, when we rebranded it and we started downloading it everywhere, this is the 100th. So thank you, everybody. That's a testament to all your support. We appreciate you liking, subscribing, and sharing all the links to the podcast. David's with me today. So what we did, we thought we'd get everybody involved again, and that's everybody out there. We asked you everywhere. David, where did we ask everybody?
We posted on X, formerly Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all of our social, basically collected questions from all of our fans.
Deer and deer hunting.
Deer, we call them fans. And we got some good ones, but yeah.
So I don't know the questions. These guys harvested. I don't have my glasses, so I can't read them off your table there. So I'm going to do my best to channel my inner Charlie Alzheimer, Leonard Lee Roux, Steve Ditchkoff brain, John Ozoga, everything I've learned over the past 30 years to answer your questions. So I know our forte here has always been about all things deer, deer behavior, biology, research, and that is my geekiness. And it's not, like I said, I extracted that from so many individuals, I would never be able to name them all, but the top whitetail minds ever in North America. So here we go, David. Give me the first one. We're going to try to get to as many of these as we can.
Actually, I want to back up just a little bit. I want to just point out that for this episode, we kind of went back and forth about what to do with it, right? We wanted to potentially just talk about the history of podcasts, which if you think about it, it's kind of interesting because when I was in high school, they were cool. When I was in college, they were non-existent, and now they're like the coolest thing in the world, which in my mind is giving me quite a bit of hope for my generation, their ability to listen to
something. I agree with you, because when we first started doing them, everybody's like, this is stupid. Why are you doing that? No one's going to listen for an hour.
Right.
And it's like, it's not necessarily to listen for an hour. We split them up. We make shorts out of them.
Yep.
There's all sorts of stuff you can do with them to present that information.
But ultimately, what we decided to do is, again, like you pointed out, we decided to ask questions to all of our fans, mainly to just kind of bring it back, have some fun, you know, where did this brand start from? It started from the stump sitters. Yep. It's all about whitetail biology, studying them, how to hunt them, deer and deer hunting. That's, you know, when I started, I always thought that was a strange name until I understood what the magazine was about. So, one of the first questions that I actually got for you came from a while ago. And I actually remember interacting with this guy on Instagram. Quick little preface. We went on a hunt this past fall with Lay McNasty. He otherwise known as, Lay McNasty is his handle. Lay McClendon?
McClendon, yep.
However you pronounce it.
Yeah, that's right.
That's right.
Okay. That's his real name. He is a TikTok social media superstar. I mean, this guy's got
millions.
Like upwards of 10 million followers. His content, I'm going to say, is not necessarily for the outdoorsman, mm-hmm. right? It's kind of cat jokes and
kid jokes.
Yep. He was a teacher. So he's a quirky dude, but he's super cool. And what I like most about him is he's unafraid to show that following the fact that he loves deer hunting,
which is pretty awesome.
He's unapologetic about it. You know, he got so much hate over going out hunting with us and hunting with everybody he's been with since. But he just keeps being him, and I think he's better off for it. Anyways, so when we went on a hunt with him, Ian over here, he went with him to Missouri?
That is correct, Missouri.
Missouri. And he got himself a nice deer, and when he posted the picture, of course, it stirred up a lot. Mm-hmm. And I went on there under the DDH profile, and I defended him, congratulated him, and then basically put out there that any of these followers who just want to learn about conservation, you know, who don't want to jump to you're a murderer, you're this, mm-hmm. you're that. No, how about you just, you know, and I think you got to do it this way is you got to be respectful. You got to present it as, hey, we're an educational source. We're not here to rub a dead animal in your face. That's not what we want to
right.
do. So I put that out there, and I remember this guy specifically. His name's Callum Callum Pike replying at the time, and he sent us a message at the time, which we haven't replied to until now. So here's the message. And you got to take
into... So my reply is to his message.
Yes. So you have to take into account the fact that Callum, I'm assuming, is not a hunter.
Okay.
But he's one of those guys who saw that post and said, maybe there is something there for me to learn.
Okay.
So that's why I want to read it, even though most of the people listening to this are going to be like, I know what that answer is.
That's pretty interesting. Okay.
All right. So Callum says, I've got a bit of a loaded question that was spurred on by Leigh McNasty's post on deer hunting. He was hunting in Missouri, where the local deer population can quickly grow out of control without human intervention. So has the native human population been hunting deer in the Missouri area ever since their arrival in America? Or was the population introduced somehow? I'm curious how humanity has such an important factor on the deer population in that area.
Oh, that's fascinating. That's actually a really good question. Right. And if you know anything about deer and you followed this for a long enough time, when settlers, I don't know if that's even politically correct, whatever, we don't care if we're politically correct. When settlers, when Europeans came here, whenever, you know,
Columbus, yeah,
hundreds of years ago, there were 30 to 35 million whitetails in North America estimated. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much what we have now. So to answer that question in short form, yes, there were deer everywhere. Mm-hmm. Along with millions of bison and everything else. Humans definitely have affected everything. I mean, look at the bison. The bison wasn't wiped out because the bison, did you guys know that story? The bison was wiped out because it was a commodity. And by wiping out the bison, white man had a stranglehold.
You.
Ted Nugent wrote about it in his song, Great White Buffalo.
Okay. Yep.
It was not because they wanted pelts and meat and all that kind of stuff. They knew by eliminating the bison, they could control the Native Americans. So humans definitely, obviously, no matter where you are going to affect the landscape. If you're looking at just from a pure whitetail perspective, the whitetail was dwindled from the time, you know, settlers got here until 1900. So you're looking at what, 1492, just say 1500. 1500 to 1900. In 400 years, we went from, let's just say, 35 million whitetails in North America to 500,000. Mm-hmm. And that's it. And most people who are uneducated say, oh, well, they needed to eat. They wanted to. No, that wasn't it. The whitetail became eventually, by the 1800s, it didn't take long, it became a commodity. And it was sold in fine restaurants in New York and Chicago and things like that. And it was just like anything else, trapping. There was a value placed on whitetails. That's where the term buck came from. David, give me $5. $5 was five deer pelts.
Pelts, yeah.
That's what they were worth because they needed the skins.
So was there any regulation back then on them?
No, there was, and that was unregulated. Mm-hmm. So when conservation came in, regulated hunting, that was market hunting, which isn't hunting. It's profiting off of a resource. They called it hunting because people were going out slaughtering deer. It's kind of potato, but
yeah.
Conservation, as we know it as hunters, didn't start until the turn of the century. And then we went from 500,000 in 1900. In less than 50 years, it was millions. Mm-hmm. But to answer his question, in Missouri, yes, the whitetails were always there. They were pretty much everywhere where you see them now. Population levels might have been different. But like if you would have gone back 500 years, you know, Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, all those places had great whitetail populations. But then by 1900, they were stalking deer from Michigan and Minnesota and Wisconsin down in the south because they were just completely depleted down there. Mm. So to answer his question, yes, deer were here. Yes, human intervention has affected it, but probably in different ways than you would think. Most of it is, transactional. There was a value. Whenever there's a value to something, humankind is going to take advantage of it in some way, shape, or form.
Well, there you go, Callum. I'm going to send this to you, buddy. Thank you very much for asking that. I appreciate it. the fact that you are showing a willingness to learn there. And yeah, I like it. And I actually got a quick follow-up question. How did the Native Americans not wipe out the buffaloes with the buffalo jump? I mean, they killed them by the hundreds.
But you know what's funny about, or I shouldn't say funny, what's ironic about that? Were you there with me when we toured that?
Yeah.
In Wyoming?
Yeah.
We look at things in a much more, would you say, linear way of looking at it? Because sure. Like when they did those buffalo jumps, it wasn't like, or even when they hunted the bison.
Yeah.
You see it like you go to Milwaukee Museum and there's a diorama of American Indian and he's on the horseback and he's shooting an arrow.
Yeah.
We think about it as like he shot that buffalo with a 100-pound recurve. What happened was that did happen.
Yeah.
But it might have taken them 5, 6, 7 days to kill that thing. Mm-hmm. And because they'd get one arrow into it, but they'd have to keep following and following. The buffalo jump, same thing. They had little kids chasing those things off of cliffs, but it wasn't like, you know, hey, David, we're going to go out on Saturday and run 500 buffalo. No, it probably took weeks.
So they killed a lot of buffalo. They just didn't do it as frequently as we're able to
right.
with our modern day
right.
gear.
And there's probably dead buffalo laying around for weeks that they're, you know, eating off of because yeah. they're like hanging the meat up in trees, like drying it and stuff like that. That what we often put our own perspective into those things. But if you go back and you think about it, it didn't happen as nice and efficient as you would thought. But how did they not kill them all? Well, number one, there was, you'd have to Google this. There was probably 60 million bison. Number two, the Native American population wasn't that big. And number three, they did only kill what they needed.
Yeah.
They were very reverent. If you want a history on conservation, go back to the Cree from Canada and you study that culture. It was religion to them.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't go run 50 bison off a cliff just to do it. They would do it, but it's like, okay, guess what? We're eating that for the next 6 months or however long it's going to take.
Yeah.
And there's no way they could have wiped them out. We came with guns and railroad trains and all sorts of other stuff, and it's like, oh, I get make money for this, and then boom, you know, it kind of took off from there. But
gotcha.
Yeah.
So, moral of the story, modern day conservation is why we have whitetails still.
Why we have everything. Why we have ducks, why we have geese, why we have sandhill cranes.
Forests.
Why we have timber wolves, why we have forests, why we have clean water. It's all because of modern day conservation. It's all because of hunters. I mean, the lion's share is because of hunters who, by the way, sidebar, who came out and said, yes, please tax us. Pittman Robertson, please yep. tax us. We will give you money on this box of ammo that I buy because I want to have this for my great, 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 great grandchildren.
Yeah. And it's one of those taxes, probably, I don't know if it's the only tax where you actually know where the money is going.
Oh, yeah. It's one of the few.
I mean, when you go to the bow shop and you buy a pack of arrows for $60,
broadheads, yeah.
That Pittman Robertson tax is actually going back into conservation efforts.
Yep. Yep.
Meaning.
And the other thing, too, is you find a lot of these public lands that were purchased.
Yeah.
That now, I mean, we had, his name slips in my mind, a guy from Colorado, Dan Gates, a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
You know, you have all these anti saying, oh, this public land. Yeah. We paid for it.
Yeah.
You know, through those funds because we want to have more wild spaces.
Right.
We want to have more wildlife. But yeah, that is one of the very few things that you can actually trace.
Right.
Yeah,
which is awesome. All right, moving on. I got to preface this one too, and I promise everybody listening, after this, I don't know anybody else on this list, except for one.
I know none of them. So.
But this one, I got to ask because she's a friend. She is a retired Dallas-Fort Worth police officer. I met her this past fall at a event. It's called Bucks for Brave.
Yep.
She had won a hunt, and it was one of the most just rewarding experiences of my life. I know it was for her too, but from just somebody going there to document, it was absolutely amazing. So Rachel DeJoyes of Texas, she says, I used to live in Central Texas, but now I'm in the panhandle of Texas, the Amarillo area. Where I have access to hunt is flat plains with some draws. Any tips for managing whitetails in this type of environment? We have a couple of feeders out near some draws, but all the wildfires were a few miles north of us. This just happened like a month ago. And I'm hoping to attract the displaced deer to our ranch. I thought about some food plots, but hunting in this type of terrain is new to me. We have a combo of mule deer and whitetails and pronghorns. Mm-hmm. So
it's a great spot.
What do you say to Rich?
It's awesome, awesome spot. I haven't hunted near Amarillo. I've hunted near Abilene and Aspermont mm-hmm. and Midland, I think, is farther west. But so I'm assuming it's Rachel.
Yep.
She's got free range property. I'm assuming most landowners in Texas have more than, it's not like us where they own 10. They own hundreds, if not more.
Yeah.
It's very difficult. And I'm not going to profess to be an expert on Texas. However, I know Bob Zaglin. I know Larry Wysoon. I know a lot of the, I followed James Kroll. I know a lot of the guys that manage land down there. It's very difficult. Western Texas, extremely difficult mm-hmm. because of the weather, because of the drought conditions. Planting food plots, that's tough. Unless you're, I mean, like hill country, maybe it's a little bit different. That's eastern part of the state.
I don't think I've ever hunted over a food plot in Texas before.
I have. I mean, and it's not food plots like we know. They call them green fields. It's a lot of like winter wheat or something mm-hmm. like rye, something like that, where they have a bigger thing. If you can do it and get away with precipitation, which is a very, very, I wouldn't do it knowing what I know. It'd be too difficult. If you had irrigation, mm-hmm. better. I know what they do in Texas, and you have to, is you have to supplement with protein. You have to, and that's protein pellets. It's expensive. If you want to draw the deer and keep them there, that's providing nutrition, mm-hmm. and that's what I would recommend. I mean, everybody, Texas gets a bad rap because, oh, there's so much corn feeding. Yeah, there's feeding during the season, and there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with even supplementing with corn, but you can't do it from a management perspective.
Yeah.
You can attract deer a little bit, but if you're in an area like that, especially with wildfires, boy, I would really almost hesitate to say to deploy food plots unless you really do your homework. I would talk to locals who have property because it's very different. I know John Heaton. I mean, he has managed so many properties up there, and he's tried to plant food plots, and he's got all the time in the world, and I shouldn't say all the resources, but a lot of resources. And a lot of times it's, I mean, turnip fields are like sandboxes. It's just very difficult. But the other thing, which Bob Zaglin, as anybody who's read Deer and Deer Hunting, you know Bob Zaglin. He's been our Southern field editor since 94, so 30 years. He does it through native habitat management in South Texas, and that's managing the native shrub species and forb species, and they do a lot of burning. And that burning, what it does is, and it's prescribed burns, which sounds intimidating if you got somebody, and a lot of people down there know how to do it, a lot of people in the country know how to do it, but if you do that, get a little bit of precipitation, that's better than any food plot you could possibly have. So I would look into that. I would look into enlisting a professional biologist on, tell me what the native landscape is here, because everything in Texas sticks you or stings you or bites you, mm-hmm. including the plants. Find out what you have. How can you manage that naturally first through burning, I would say. And then look at, I would say, maybe food plots possibly if you get enough rain. And then definitely look at protein supplementation.
All right. Cool.
That wasn't too hard. That wasn't that bad of a question, actually.
Hopefully that helps you out, Rachel. Okay, let's get into some whitetail geekery. That is what I believe our real specialty is.
Okay.
And your specialty, because you're a nerd.
I pretend to.
Okay. This, I think, came from Instagram. Don't know the guy's name. His handle is The Rock Hunter. Has anyone / entity researched smells or scents released by deer when they feel they are in danger?
Yes.
Elaborate.
No, I don't know the specific research. There was research. Oh, Lenny Rue reported on this 40 years ago, at least. And I don't know. So whoever's from the state agency that actually did the original research on interdigital glands, that's the gland in between a deer's hoof. there is scent that we all know about. There's interdigital scent that you can buy. Mm-hmm. Wildlife Research, other companies, they've sold this stuff throughout the years. Basically, it's gross. It's a waxy, cheesy substance that's in between their toes. Mm-hmm. And that scent has been shown to...
Goes good with crackers.
It's gross. It's nasty. I know it smells. which is different than preorbital scent, because preorbital, the stuff in the eyeballs, is waxy. It doesn't even smell it. I can't smell anything. But anyways, the interdigital scent, they know is individual to each deer, and they know that deer can differentiate each other by that smell, which is flat out amazing. And there has been research with blood trailing dogs, hounds, that when they're on a blood trail, more often than not, they're trailing the scent from the interdigital gland when that hoof hits the ground.
So they secrete out of their hooves when that adrenaline, that fear kind of kicks in.
Well, that is the premise, is that because that scent is there no matter what.
Yeah.
But now if there is, it's not adrenaline, but whatever your body secrete a deer to, what's secreted in the bloodstream from flight or fright and flight response comes through that interdigital smell, and it can be distinguished as a danger scent from deer to deer. But when you think about it, okay, you watch a dog take off after a track, you watch a deer following another deer's track. And we talk about epithelium, and it only takes one molecule of scent. It's like, I can't wrap my head around that. Because you could take that hoof and shove it up to your face or my face. Oh, I can't smell anything. I mean, maybe if you squeeze the stuff out of there and smear it on your hand, which is not going to be a lot, it's going to be a little bit. You probably could, because it's probably going to smell like tarsal gland. You know, like, you know, when you get close to a tarsal gland, it'll probably be maybe not even that similar. But that's what blows my mind, is how another individual animal could actually pick that up off a leaf or the dirt or... you know, running through somewhere else. But to answer his question, yes, there has been research on it. Of course, I would have to go in the archives to pull it out, but we've reported on that in the magazine numerous times over the years.
Okay, so follow up. Off the top of your head, can you name all the different glands / areas that a whitetail secretes?
I can, but not... scent. But the number, okay, there's...
And what's the scent for? Come on, we got an hour.
Okay, there's the forehead scent, which is from right here, and that's what they deposit on licking branches,
like the center of their forehead.
Yep, right here. There's a gland there.
There's something open.
Isn't that the preorbital gland?
Preorbital. Thank you. There's the
smartass. Okay, go.
Preorbital is in. God, you're gonna get me. There's the tear ducts.
Yep.
There's the forehead gland. There are the tarsal glands. There's the interdigital glands. Those are the easy ones to name. Now you're going to get me on the
other. How many do you think?
There's at least 7 or 9. I don't know. There's at least...
They definitely have more than us.
I don't even know how many we have.
Depends.
The ones that we talk about are the easy ones. But you said, are there different messages? The messages are all the same. Basically, is it's deer identifying each other. Which is like they know individual deer. And now let's just say during the rut, another buck comes in and he works that licking branch.
So is it kind of like when you're like, you can identify like a neighbor's household by its scent. Mm-hmm. So it's like we're identifying them, which is weird if you think about it.
Or like if you wear cologne, or if I work cologne, and it's like, oh, David wears, I don't know, cologne, Polo, and Ian wears Old Spice. Old Spice for millennials.
Ian wears sex pants.
We wear Axe body spray.
Axe body spray. And then it's like, oh, that's David. It's kind of like that. And I hate to use those examples, but it's kind of like that. Because they can definitely, and it's just like dogs. You know, dogs smell each other's butts. They know each other. They know that that's Rover. But like, if they're not familiar with each other, then they know that there was other deer here. You know, there's other deer coming through the area. But yeah, it's that way. Right. But what I can never wrap my head around is the minute amount of scent that it takes for a deer to figure that out is just mind blowing. It's very small.
It's kind of like when you smell a truck stop bathroom when you're still on the road. Yes. It's like, whoa, we're close.
You can smell it right now if you go to Iola. But yeah.
Yeah. We'll stop at a quick trip in Iowa. Okay, moving on then. Let's see. I'm just going to pick
good
one
questions,
out of a hat.
Good questions.
No, I don't like that
one. I hope you guys are having fun.
No, I don't like that one either. Okay, all right, here we go.
Okay.
Jaden Duquette. Why do deer in my area, the northern Adirondacks, prefer spruce as a licking branch, especially when the tree has plenty of its own scent? Pine scent.
Where is he from?
The Adirondacks.
Adirondacks.
Well, however you say that.
Adirondacks. Northern New York. I did a speaking engagement up there once in north of Rochester, I think.
We should hunt there. I've never been.
It's tough. You want to talk about tough hunting? That is tough hunting. I've never hunted it, but I know it's Charlie.
Tougher than Pennsylvania?
Yeah. Charlie wrote a book about hunting the Adirondacks.
But he lived there, right?
He lived in Western New York, but it was a drive for him. But that is among the most difficult places to hunt. Why do bucks make licking branches on spruce?
Yeah, like why do they prefer that over an oak?
That surprises me. Because now I'm going to assume. Okay, any of you Northeastern people hunters who are watching this, you're going to have to help me because I am a tree guy, but I'm not super familiar with the species of spruce in the Adirondacks. I'm going to assume it's black spruce. Doesn't really matter. But like there's only a few different types of spruce that you're going to find across the country. Black spruce, blue spruce is more of a Colorado thing that has been proliferated across the country. White spruce, red spruce is a Norway spruce, which is actually introduced. Why would deer do that? I don't know. But my assumption would be that's a predominant species there. And I know in that area of the country, it is conifer city. I mean, it's like going to some places in Canada, that's all you find are conifers. So you're going to have like, I don't know what kinds of pine, probably red pine, white pine, whatever other types of pine, tamarack, which isn't technically a conifer, but it's like a conifer. It actually is the only evergreen that loses its needles. So you can get me off on tangents.
It's beautifully yellow in the fall.
Just gorgeous. I'm assuming it's predominant, but as far as his comment on, because it has its own scent, that's not why they work licking branches. They work licking branches to deposit scent. Now, if you're in the Midwest or even the Southeast or up here, the predominant species you're going to find on licking branches are oaks and maples and birch and things that have a little bit of stoutness to them, because you do find some on pines. I know mm-hmm. you find some up where you hunted. Mostly that would be red pine. White pine they eat the heck out of. So like a buck, normally when he works a licking branches, he likes to chew that, as I'm sure Jaden knows. He'll mm-hmm. chew that branch as it's down. And if it's an oak branch or a maple branch, hard maple, that can take a lot of abuse, especially a stem that's thick enough.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where they're going to deposit their scent, and it's going to be a scrape for a long time. But on a spruce, the scent, you got to take that out of the equation.
They don't care about it.
They don't care about it. They're just looking for a place to lay down the scent. Why they do it on spruce, I don't know. But
good positioning.
I would think it's just the preponderance of the tree species would be my guess. They have nothing else basically to work off of. And you find that with rubs too. They prefer pines. They prefer rosiny type things, but if they don't have it, they're going to rub on fence posts. I mean, they find that in Illinois and Iowa all the time. There's not a lot of trees where they're going to work something.
Deer Talk Now is brought to you by GameHide. At GameHide, the philosophy is pretty simple. Design the best products with the best fabrics and features to help you be more successful in the field. While doing this, they strive to keep their pricing moderate to give you the best value in the hunting clothing industry. I wear the Elimitic line of clothing to keep those nasty ticks off of me, and I absolutely love it. Check them out at GameHide.com.
Okay, so sticking on the subject of licking branches, we do a lot of mock scrape stuff here. And even though I film a whole bunch of it, I'm not always paying attention. What about whether it's a natural or a mock scrape that you're putting up? What about the branch actually attracts the deer? Like, I know a guy land management guy, yep. who he does say the bushier the better when it comes to those branches. Is that true? And what branches should you be grabbing?
I think there's truth to that, but I think there's more truth. This is what Charlie taught me, is the licking branch itself has to be stout. It has to be something that is not going to get trashed, because if a deer trashes it, if they chew it, if they break it on a mock scrape, they're going to move on and make a scrape somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And so the species, that's another thing Charlie taught us, the species is important for your area. So you have to find out what is the preferred species. Charlie, I know they had a lot of beech, they had maple, they had red oak.
And this is in the New York
area. That was in Western New York, Finger Lakes region. Up here, Wisconsin, for us, be red oak, maples, sometimes a hickory, but sometimes that's too stout. Aspen can be, but that's a soft wood and they'll chew it. So the more they're, I'm talking about a mock scrape, if you put out in the bushy part, is that allows them to deposit a lot more scent. So I don't know who told you that, but that is true. So when they're
Steve Bartello,
I was going to guess it was Steve. When they're rubbing their eyeballs and their forehead up in there, they're getting a lot of scent on that.
So are they just getting high kind of when they're doing that? Like, are they just in like a mind
they're
frenzy?
Like a dog rolling in the grass. Well, they're like a dog that found a sardine can because they walked past my office and I threw the sardine can out in the yard and the dog's going to roll in it. A deer is kind of that way with a scrape, with a licking branch, and they want to get as much scent up in there as possible. Also, I think a lot of it is just, it's kind of like a reaction. You know, they get up in there and they're kind of doing their thing. Mm-hmm. But it just to have one stem, versus one that's got multi-stems and leaves and some brush on it, I would go with the one that's got more mass to it. But it has to be stout. It has to be secured very, very tightly. Whether you're putting it on a fence post or you're putting it on a tree or using one of those active branches, really cool things that Wildlife Research Center has that you put the things down in there.
Yeah.
So they can't break that off. Because if they do break it off and you don't get back there for a week or two, you might have missed your window. Not to say they're not going to scrape or work a licking branch anywhere near there, but it's that repeatability that you want, where they're going to come through there every day, hopefully, or a deer will, and work it.
Gotcha. All right, cool. All right, moving on.
These are some good questions.
I got another one here, and we didn't want to get soapboxy with this episode, so we're not going to really talk about disease, specifically CWD, right?
Okay.
But I do have a question that kind of relates, but not so much. So this came from a guy named Ted from Michigan.
Ted from Michigan. Does he live kind of near Jackson?
I don't know. But anyways, last name Nugent. Okay, it came from Ted Nugent. So he says, how can deer naturally congregating and eating apples under an
this
apple
really,
tree?
This really is from Ted, isn't it?
Yeah, no, Ted Nugent replied to our thing.
Wow. Thank you, sir.
Yeah. Thanks, Ted. How can deer naturally congregating and eating apples under an apple tree be scientifically different than eating apples that I put in front of my blind, which is a total Ted thing to say,
and it's
which
true.
Is true.
It's true. He speaks the truth.
Right.
I'm not going to hide anything here. You know, Ted is a friend of mine, but I disagree with him on a lot of things.
Yeah.
This one I do not disagree with him on.
Right.
There is no separate biology for some guy who's got a overgrown commercial apple orchard where he took the fences down, mm-hmm. versus somebody who took 5 or 10 gallons of apples and put that in a strategic spot near the tree stand.
Right.
There isn't none, number one. Number two, now I could go down on some rabbit holes here. There, if you look at all the regulations on baiting and feeding, all the regulations, and no matter where state, if there's a state that has a ban, what is the number one reason why they have it? I'm going to let you answer that question.
CWD spreading.
Disease concerns. Because it's about unnatural CWD. Concentration of deer. That's what it's couched as. Doing this for 30 years, I could care less. I've got private land. I can plant food plots. I can hunt. I don't need to put out bait.
Which, if you... Really, another point that I know Ted makes is that putting food plots in is baiting.
It is baiting. So we could take this many different ways. But I'm saying, like, let's just take that out. I could care less is what I'm saying. But the fact of the matter remains is A, I'm calling BS on every state biologist who claims that this prevents this. These are in place to prevent disease. Yeah. That is nonsense. Because if we were really concerned about preventing diseases, you're going to laugh at this. There would be absolutely no way we would be selling bird seed in America. No way. Because there is no, there is disease rampant among bird populations mm-hmm. because of bird feeders, but because those are skewed towards people who like to sit and sip their coffee, we're not going to worry about that concern, but we're going to worry about chronic wasting disease.
I don't think we'd be selling anything from China either. Just saying.
Okay. So, but to get back to that point is where was I going with this? There's no difference. There's no difference there. And show me, please, anyone, I beseech you, since chronic wasting disease was found east of the Mississippi, I defy you to show me one example of where that disease has spread faster or has spread at all because of feeding. It's nonsense. It's ridiculous. That should not be the case. If you see city sharpshooting programs, what are they doing? They're hunting them over bait.
Mm-hmm.
Across the country. Well, we have to control these populations. We have to control them with hunting, too. And let's face it, the guys who are vocal against baiting predominantly are either A, uneducated, and what I mean by that is they don't understand deer densities, or B, they have enough land that, like, now I don't have, you know me, I have 9 acres, mm-hmm. but they've got 100, 200, they don't care.
Yeah.
They would rather have it that you can't bait on your 5 acres. But now go to Pennsylvania and New York and Michigan and Wisconsin and Alabama and Minnesota and Iowa and all these places, I could name a million more states, where we desperately need hunters to control deer populations, but the guy is limited to 10 acres or 15 acres or 20 acres. You're not killing a lot of deer. I don't care how you do it. But there's the two sides. This becomes a polar thing where you've got to take sides. But to answer Ted's question, there is no difference.
No difference. Ultimately, it's all BS, and you and I will still be planting our baiting plots this spring.
Yeah, I'll be planting brassicas and turnips and whatever else I can so I see some deer.
All right. Thank you, Ted from Michigan, whoever you are.
Whoever you are.
Okay. This one comes with a picture. Wait, hold on. I think I printed it on the back. Yeah, I did. Okay.
Oh, okay.
All it says is, what are we seeing here? And I'm going to show, first off, I'm going to show this picture to that camera for anybody. Okay. You can zoom in and you can take a look at it as well.
Okay. Don't have my glasses. I see that.
Describe what it is for the listeners.
It's a buck. It looks, is that a polished antler right there? Right here on that one side, the one that's sticking up in the air.
Yes, it's okay. One polished antler, seemingly no antler on the other side, but...
Well, what's hanging down there is what would have been the start of the growth of an antler.
It kind of just looks like one big testicle.
Yeah, it's a big blob. That happens. You know, there's so many... In this situation with a deer like that, it could be genetic, it could be an injury, it's going to be one of the two. I'm going to assume that it was some type of pedicle injury, so that where the base of the antler is, something happened to it, and it grew down. And why you see that big bulb at the end
mm-hmm.
is when that grows, that's living tissue. You did one video with me, right? Where you have if you have a velvet antler, say in July or August,
yeah,
you could take your knife and cut that thing right in half.
Mm-hmm.
You could grab that and cut it. It's like a finger.
It's soft. It's spongy.
Yep, and it's all blood. So that kind of will pool down there. In cases like this, normally when you find a deer like that, he'll have busted that off long or very quickly. Like when he could bust it and they could bleed to death too. You see that in cases, especially guys who are having closures. If that deer hit something, that could break off and the deer could literally bleed to death. But
otherwise, it's going to harden just like a normal antler would, and it's just like one big turkey leg on
his
head?
Not at the bottom of it. The bottom of it, a lot of times, they'll be black and they'll be gross. It'll be like, it won't be completely calcified if it's that thick. Sometimes you see it. You'll see it with like the hole in the horn buck, I think it was.
Yeah.
Had one of those little weird antlers. And it was a little ball, but it was smaller. Mm. And it was hardened underneath there, but it's always going to have that black appearance on there while it's still on the deer's head. But on a case like that, I would say almost 10 times out of 10, that thing's probably going to be broken off by the time that deer, if, wherever this deer is, it's going to be a month or two into
hunting season. October 16th that it was taken. So he had it for a while.
He had it for a while. Yeah. It's, I'm not saying never, but I've very seldom seen a deer come through that's been quote unquote harvested by a hunter that still had something that's that pronounced. Yeah. But it's a cool example. Lots of weird things with antlers when they start growing and getting injured.
There are some mutant deer out there. We like to see them all. Okay, this is probably the hardest question that was submitted by user handle Peak Marty, okay. I want to say. Why did the deer cross the road?
Why did the deer cross the road? Why did the deer cross the road?
In the situation, it's a buck. Why'd the buck cross the road?
Buck crossed the road. I'm not going to go off on my weird rant because you're the only one who's going to get it. he crossed the road to get away from the lunacy of the CWD regulations in his state.
I thought he crossed the road just to increase my insurance premium again.
Oh, there we go. There we go.
Personally.
Did you ever think about that, though? Like, we've written stories about this.
Yeah.
And I apologize to anybody who's going to take offense to this, but, you know, because so I just prefaced it. People say, well, you know why that is because, you know, the state wants all the deer killed because there's the insurance lobby. And it's like, if you really thought about that for a minute, the insurance lobby would probably want more deer because they could keep raising premiums. Like, let's just say we had the, let's just pretend that,
yeah,
in our state we have,
I mean, they still have to pay out though,
like, yes, they, you know, they do, so. But if they had, if let's just pretend like the state had the scientifically responsible deer population of, you know, like I said, you give people 30 deer per square mile and they're gonna think you've killed all the deer.
Yeah,
but let's just say you got it to 30 or down to 20. Eventually they couldn't keep raising your rates because, you know what I'm saying? If mm-hmm. that made any sense.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, that there's a balance there, right? Because an insurance company's biggest profit is always going to be when all they have to do is collect the premium.
Then to that, I would say, like I said, I don't have a dog in the fight. I would just say,
you don't have insurance.
I do, but I would just say for anybody who believes that we've written this story. I don't know. Charlie wrote one back in 95.
Yeah.
Unless it's the best kept secret, because I know there's how many thousands of people listening to this podcast. You know somebody who works in the insurance industry. You mm-hmm. obviously do. You ask them what drives insurance rates.
Yeah.
It's not like, hey, we want all the deer. There's nobody. I defy somebody. Bring somebody to me and prove me wrong. So. That there's somebody in your state capital lobbying to have all the deer killed because they're from the insurance company.
So deer drive insurance rates, young first-time male yep. drivers.
Yep.
And my wife.
Ooh, boy. You better edit that out.
Keep
you
it in.
You better keep edit that out. Sarah, I sincerely apologize.
I'm just kidding. My wife works here. She knows she's subject to whatever jokes I want to make.
Okay, two more questions.
Two? Dude, I got so many.
Okay, give me as many as you can.
Okay, well, okay. I'm going to give you two from fans, and then I got one for you.
Okay.
Hold on, let me find one more.
And if you guys are listening to this, you have more questions, please just write them in the comments because we'll do another one of these.
This is a good one.
This is fun.
Yes, to whatever Dan just said. I have a quick question, says Tyler Sharp. I believe this is a Facebook message from December. So sorry, Tyler, we're just getting back to you. Wow. But at least we're getting back to you in a really cool way. This past Saturday, so that would have been December, I harvested a yearling, I assume, piebald doe in North Carolina. I just wanted to know what causes a deer to be piebald. Is it due to interbreeding? Do all deer carry this gene?
It's a recessive gene. So it would be no different than the rabbits that I raise, the domestic rabbits, or cattle or anything else. It's a recessive gene. Do all deer carry it? No. It's just like any gene that you or I would have.
Mm-hmm.
So it's in populations. What causes it? It's a mutated gene.
So it's kind of like my daughter having blue eyes.
Yep.
Despite I have obviously a dominant eye gene of being brown.
And the reason why I always wear a baseball cap because I'm bald, because my mom's dad carried.
And Sarah has hazel eyes.
Yeah.
So.
But that's different. Those are genes. Like a recessive gene is what is something in, like twins, right? Like that's a recessive gene, isn't it? For like humans.
I think so.
Okay, some of you guys help me with
this. I mean,
it's
genetics.
It's genetics.
Theoretically, I could have twins. It's supposed to skip a generation, too.
It stays in populations, though, which is a good question that he has. Because you see that in pockets across the country. There's one here in Wisconsin over in Buffalo County that has pockets of albinos.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another one that's actually not too far north of here that where you see a lot of piebalds. And that stays within that local population. And that would be almost impossible to eradicate because you wouldn't know. There'd be normal deer walking around that had that recessive gene. The other thing that a sidebar is a lot of states, I don't want to say most because I don't know the number, but a lot of the states, I would say preponderance of states, allow you to harvest piebald deer but not albinos, which is ridiculous. It is an inferior trait.
Mm-hmm.
Just because they're pretty, I don't think they should be protected. But that's neither here nor there. To answer his question, it's in the genes.
It's in the genes.
It's in the genes.
I'm going to not make a joke on that one. Okay. I'm just going to randomly pick. I got like three more here, but I'm going to pick one of them. They're all pretty simple, I'd say, for you.
Okay.
Let's go with Bailey Mack. Asks.
We know Bailey.
We do?
Yeah, he sent us that video. He was doing the... He sent us... He's a younger guy from the South, right?
All right, well, then I'm going with someone else.
Oh.
I'm just kidding.
No, we got to ask this question.
No, he did a short with us, yeah.
He did a video. He sent us a
video.
Yeah,
he had a question about some land.
Was he that short where, like, there was a bunch of construction?
Yes.
Yep.
And he was trying to figure out how to handle
that? How to handle it, yep.
Okay, answer that question real quick.
Okay, so Bailey, this was last year, right, Ian?
Yeah, you followed up with basically just a response, and yeah, you can go into
it. Basically, he had started hunting his parents' land or somebody's land, and he had a small place to hunt, and the neighbors basically were just like major construction going on, and he wanted to know how that would affect the deer. It's like, it's definitely going to affect the deer, and my response to him was, you're going to probably have to adjust the times you hunt, and it's kind of like if you're hunting in a city area, and you see a lot of deer. Let's say you have a small access to a 5 or 10 acres in a suburban area. You know there's a lot of deer, and you want to go hunt. You have to completely change your mindset. Normally, probably hunting at dusk, and that's probably maybe early in the morning, but getting there super early, being very conscious about your wind direction, and then just realize that construction's not going to last forever, that mm-hmm. commotion, and the deer will come back to their patterns, but you're probably going to have to find some other places to hunt, like a couple backup spots, and then only hit that spot where the construction's going on. Like I said, you'll be looking at some short hunts, two, 3 hours, and maybe a lot more sitting in the dark than you want to do to capitalize. It's not a super secret. It's basically just being super smart about your entrance and exits and trying to catch those deer as they're cutting through on the fringe hours of daylight.
Okay. So Bailey's new question is, what is the best food for whitetails in the summer?
Depends. Like if you're near egg or if you're planting food plots, if you're planting stuff, Steve's recipe of,
Cereal, yeah, I mean, like, if you were to just, like...
Rye and oats and grasses and...
I mean, it also depends, I think, where you're at, right? So, like, if you were to just give, like, a universal answer... Because, like, I'll use my dad as an example. He listens to almost everything that we do, mm-hmm. right? Proud of his kid. I appreciate that. But he's, like, he'll listen to Steve and talk about chestnut trees. Mm-hmm. and he'll immediately just jump to, like, he doesn't consider region at all, right? So he immediately jumps to, oh, well, I got to get do that. Or
yeah.
Or now he's convinced he's got to plant beets, you know? And I know they like beets, they like sugar beets, but...
Is your soil going to grow them? Yeah.
Right. So what is, if you were to give a universal, kind of doesn't matter where you live, this is a pretty safe bet. Thing to plant.
There really isn't a safe bet because it's so varied in the south and the north. In the south, it's a lot. Honestly, the best stuff in summer mm-hmm. would be forbs, which is a fancy word for weeds.
Yeah.
And weed management, because those broadleaf weeds are, you know, deer are browse creatures. And yeah, are they going to be eating? I mean, if you've got a beautiful alfalfa, you know how hard it is to plant or to get alfalfa to get. If you're just a guy, mm-hmm. if you're not a farmer, that's difficult.
So if you're hunting a small like wood area or something, would you say, in that case,
just berry browse,
try to get some sunlight to the ground.
So get sunlight to the ground. Like example, to use your dad's example, let's just say you have woods and you don't have food plots, and you know the if you have a brush hog or you can rent one for $60 for the day.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got a bunch of overgrown berry brush, you go in there and mow that, like, okay, we're doing this in spring, this podcast. You mow that now in spring or even in May or even early June. That's the best food you can have.
Yeah.
If you've got that. If you've got berry brush, oh my gosh, you're going to have tons of deer in there. Because not only are you going to get in that berry regrowth, you're going to be getting anything that's underneath there.
Mm-hmm.
And chances are there's going to be some preferred weeds, but there's also going to be some preferred woody stems like popple or, you know, aspen popple, the same thing, or, you know, maple or something in there, depending upon where you're at. Southern guys have a little bit tougher because you do that in a piney, sandy area. What are you coming back? It could be kudzu or something that they're not going to eat.
Mm-hmm.
So it really depends. But if you can plant something, I would not try to overthink it. I would, and I know this is a deflecting answer, but I would ask somebody in your area, what is a good thing that's gonna, because you're wasting a lot of time and energy and money.
Yeah.
By just grabbing a bag of something that somebody says, hey, this grows great. Well, you took that completely out of context and you planted it at the wrong time.
Yeah.
And you didn't know your soil situation. You didn't know your pH. If you can plant, I know people don't want to hear this. They want me to tell them, plant this seed. What I'm going to say is find out what your pH is first and amend that soil.
Yeah. Well, you know? I mean, I personally can only speak because I'm not even close to as an expert as anybody else who works here. But last year, my experience was that, you know, my father-in-law and our neighbor, Rick, we just gained control. Rick bought a field that I had been hunting for 7 years,
yep.
right? And the farmers had been leasing that field, and they put alfalfa in there. They put clover at one point, winter wheat. Like, they, you know, they mix it up and corn every 4 years.
Which is smart, by the way.
Yeah, and I never, well, yeah, from a farming perspective.
Yes.
From a deer
from a soil perspective, too.
From a deer hunting perspective, I found success there, but it was nothing.
Right.
Like when we finally took over.
Right.
Right. Because last year what they did was late spring, it's a 7-acre field. So mm-hmm. we way over killed what we needed. Right. It's so much so that the deer were on the other side of the field every time I went to go hunt. But we, in the late spring, we planted brassicas on the entire thing. And we're talking like as big as a, like double softball size.
Monsters. So they had
monster
the
turnips.
Yeah.
Radishes, you name it, and those things. The deer were flooded there all season long. Again, what we didn't account for was getting them close enough to our bow stands.
Mm-hmm.
But what was really surprising to me is that those brassicas and everything, due to their size and due to the quantity that we planted, they lasted throughout the entire winter. I mean, up until a couple weeks ago, and it's the end of March, yeah. Right now, up until a few weeks ago, there were still visible turnips that they were eating. And so they were there all winter. And I really figured that out when I went shed hunting. And again, I hunted this spot for 7 years. Over those 7 years, I maybe found 3 sheds mm-hmm. total. Last year on this one field, I found over 11 sheds.
Didn't you tell me, though, also that they planted things other than brassicas in there.
I think it was a big blend. Like, I think there were a couple rows on the west side of the field or the east side of the field that was wheat, like winter wheat.
Mm-hmm.
I think. And actually, that's kind of where, during bow season, those bigger deer congregated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it was all blended in. There were still turnips and stuff over there. But they definitely congregated on that far side where we had absolutely no stands.
The only reason I bring that up is I've learned through Steve and other people the hard way in that is very tempting when you get something that comes in so fantastic like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's like, oh, man, I'm going to screw brassicas. And then you have a failure, and then you've got an entire failure.
Yeah.
So to have that diversity, like, I know the guys are like my buddy Corey, you know Corey,
yeah,
and Michael, they plant in between rows. There's some really fancy stuff that you can do, mm-hmm, that where if you do have either a crop failure or the deer just come in and obliterate whatever you put in there, there's something else that's coming in there too. But that's for food plotting. Yes. If you've got that option, and especially like 7 acres, a lot of food, little tiny plots, mostly kill plots. If you're getting like quarter acre, I mean, a quarter of the size of a football field, half the size of a football field, that's a candy bar. It's not going to last for very long. So if that's the only food that you have, you got to start thinking of some other ways.
Well, let me ask you this, because obviously our overall goal is to hunt and kill big deer.
Yep.
But the goal that we really achieved was getting them to finally congregate here rather than at the neighbors, right?
Mm-hmm.
But considering you got to get them within bow range, is there a point to where a plot is too big?
I don't think so, because I take it from a different perspective. If I had 7 acres of just food, I would not be putting many of my eggs in that basket to hunt that field.
Mm-hmm.
I would be basing my hunting strategies in the woods around the field, which is a lot more difficult. You're not going to see as many deer. It's not going to be as fun, but your hunting is going to be more productive.
So you want to build a community dining table for them, but you want to hunt the trails that they come on.
Once you start doing that, especially if you're hunting bigger deer, it only takes a season or two,
mm-hmm,
and then your law of diminishing returns really starts coming down. They figure the game out pretty quickly. They're still going to use the field, but now they're using it at night.
Gotcha.
But I would be focusing most of my hunting efforts not on that field edge. It would be, and it's frustrating because you do get the deer to come in there, but like you said, they're 100 yards out and you're bow hunting.
Well, and to your credit, the one deer that we killed off of that field, I killed out of a saddle, on a trail.
Yes.
So,
and he was coming in off of that. That's a good question.
Yeah. Okay. That is it for submitted questions.
Okay.
So thank you, everybody.
Thank you very much, everybody.
I want to close it out with a question to you.
Okay.
And I want you to get as geeky as you want to. Dan Schmidt grew up wanting to be the editor-in-chief of Deer and Deer Hunting magazine, something I always admire him for, because he made it happen. We all know you love deer, but what is like the most fascinating factoid about whitetails, like in Dan Schmidt's head? Mine is just their simple will to live. I don't know if there's a scientific reason for it, but what is Dan Schmidt's, like, this is the most...
The
amazing
thing that I find most fascinating is deer blood. And what I mean by
which that, you're allergic to, right?
Which I'm allergic to. I'm allergic to deer in general. I'm allergic to hair, blood.
Yeah.
Not so much as I was in the past. As you know, the physiology part of it fascinates me, because it's God's creation right there in front of us. And it's not just a deer, but it's every, you know, all mammals and creatures. But when, I mean, I could go off on, okay, I'm going to go off a little bit.
That's fine.
The skeleton, how the skeleton's put together, how that scapula is put together, why it's built the way it is. Is it built to allow that deer to run? Yes. Is it built to allow that deer to withstand hard pounding, jarring exercise, whatever? Yes. It's also built, I think, as a shield for its heart and lungs. Because you look at how thick that thing is, that's not just, that's by design. But I could go through the deer, the epithelium on the nose, how they can, what we were talking about, they can smell one little iota of, one molecule of scent, and know that there's danger 250 yards to the east.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, This would have been a researcher by the name of Dutch Wombold, and he was from, I can't remember if it's UK or somewhere over there, and he was studying roe deer. The small ones with the little antlers, and they look like little forks, but that's like a monster. And he was studying blood of a deer, and he described it as a deer's blood is a working hospital. And to me, I've learned that 35 years ago, reading it in the magazine before I even worked here. Mm-hmm. And when I got here, then they did studies on how much B endorphin is in a deer's system and how much vitamin K is in the blood. And it's like, well, how do they get higher levels of vitamin K than we do? Because they eat all this green leafy vegetation that we talked about. Mm-hmm. And why is that? Because it assists clotting. Do you ever think about that? You've shot a deer, you've wounded a deer, you didn't recover it, you hit one in the shoulder with a big sever broadhead, and not that we wish that would ever happen, but it happens, and the deer survives it. Because that blood is just like this super powerful thing that can heal. Yeah. And then you look at
100 yards into the trail, blood stops.
Blood stops. Yeah. And the deer survives. And it's like, oh, we have pictures of it, 4 weeks later, and we shot it during gun season.
Yeah.
And that's not because of faulty equipment. It's because that deer is built to survive. And it's all because of the inner workings of a deer.
So there is a scientific will to survive.
Scientific.
Yeah.
And to me, it's scientific and it's God's creation. It's two things combined that I can never learn it all. I can never be... like lose fascination with how that stuff works.
Yeah.
And then like the other thing, then they'd always ask me, you know me, I'm always asking questions. And I know I bring this one up a lot. It's like, why is that blood maroon and why is that pink? Well, there's different minerals and different things with the oxygen that's going on within the blood. I'm like, I still can't get that. Hmm. But to me, that's what excites me about the animal. But then the more I learn, and we talk about behavior and we talk about eyesight and hearing and then when you learn these things, I had guys when I used to do my speaking engagements, they'd stand up and it's like, you didn't teach me anything on how to hunt. And I said, but if you listen to this stuff, then when you go hunting, blood, maybe not so much as far as behavior, but behavior, then you say, oh, that's why that deer snapped its head up and looked at the field and I didn't see anything come out. But then 10 minutes later, a deer stepped out. Because of its hearing and its eyesight. And then once you learn about how they're wired like that, we always say, let the deer teach you how to hunt them. That's one thing, but then you can just marvel in it. But to me, that's what excites me. What excites me is the deer itself. What makes this happen? Why does this happen? Why was it created this way? And I don't think, as Fred Bear told Jack Brower, he thought we'd run out of things to talk about. I don't think we ever will, because I think that's why the whitetail, I think, is America's favorite game animal, is because do other animals have some of the same things? Yes, but the whitetail is so intricately complicated, you know, that there's always going to be things like that even though we probably, I think I knew that, you're still going to be fascinated by it.
Yeah. Right.
So
good answer.
You nailed that right on. I'm going to hit it right there, right on an hour.
Cool.
Right in an hour, and I hope you have plenty of like shorts and snippets that you can disseminate, Ian, across the platform.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Thank you for joining us. That was quite a ramble. We want to do this again. Just send us your questions. We'll keep them in the bank, and we'll bring them again. For David Galane, I am Dan Schmidt, and for Ian Sanchez, thank you for joining us for Deer Talk Now. Like and subscribe. That's all we ask you to do. It costs you nothing. And share it with your friends. Until next Thursday, we'll catch you again for another episode of Deer Talk Now.